watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this
week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. One of the most widely repeated myths in America is that capitalism and the free market are responsible for American prosperity and its hallmark manifestation, the American middle class. We'll hear on the program this week that the middle class is not a byproduct of capitalism, but quite the contrary. It's a condition that has been brought about politically through confrontation and control of the market. The natural process of capitalism leads to the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, a mechanism simply demonstrated by the board game Monopoly. We can understand this through the lens of debt and interest, the basis of the monetary system. The debtor continues to get poorer as a result of compounding interest, while the lender continues to get richer. A person who borrows $100,000 to buy a house with a 30-year fixed mortgage at the rate of 6% will end up paying more than $215,000 for that house by the time it's paid off. They will have transferred an additional $115,000, more than the house originally cost, to the lender, someone who already had wealth. That, in a nutshell, is the condition of most of the people in what is called the middle class. They transfer what income they get to those already wealthy for the promise of a modicum of material comfort. Indeed, to speak about the middle class presupposes the existence of two other classes, both of which, in my view, are unacceptable for opposite reasons. By this, I'm not suggesting that the middle class is some sort of an ideal. Far from it. I'm a child of that class, raised in one of its American dream suburbs of cheaply built cookie-cutter houses with two cars in the driveways. As a child, I watched my father, a brilliant man who worked as an engineer for what are now called defense contractors, spend his life in frustration, doomed over and over again to kowtow to a hierarchy of people apparently far less intelligent than he, but who had the skills to succeed and rise in the corporate hierarchy, the skills of ass-kissing and golf-playing. I saw that my parents were miserable in their American dream, and it seemed most of my friends' parents weren't too happy either. To we children, growing up to be our parents, to assume their life, seemed a fate worse than death. If you go to the shopping malls, the temples of the American middle class, and look at the faces of the people, what you'll see is unhappiness and yearning. People are told that consumption is the answer to that yearning, but that consumption never seems to deliver. The victims of this lie then consume more furiously, but the need is never filled, because the need is for love, for meaning, for beauty. These things are not and have never been for sale. Americans are, as far as I can see, across the board, a very unhappy people. Even those vitriolic defenders of the system, the ditto heads, who who seem to have been manipulated into finding scapegoats for their misery, be they immigrants, gay people, feminists, whatever. This unhappiness, caused by consumerism's failure to deliver, is, I think, also responsible for the rise of fundamentalist religion, whose overall tenor is one of rage, whose promise is to fill the emptiness inside through the vanquishing of the sinners. I don't think there's any way to reform this system, any way it can be made to deliver what life is really all about. I do think it's a big mistake, a system that needs to be swept away before it annihilates life on this planet, rebuilt from the ground up. But that is not at all the topic of political discourse in this election year. The rhetoric from both parties is about saving the middle class, the American dream, the economy, making capitalism work, and so on. So this week, we'll hear critique and analysis from dissident supporters of the system, which some fear has been brought to the verge of total collapse through greed and fraud, the constant companions of the market. The main body of the program will be a very interesting talk by an author and host on the Liberal Air America radio network, Tom Hartman. It's actually quite hopeful in many ways. But I'll begin by offering a few things that I hope will give you a further understanding of the meltdown of the economic house of cards now in progress, coming from people within the financial world that you're unlikely to hear even in the mainstream business press, which is just as censored as other areas of the corporate press. For most people, economics is a mysterious area shrouded in jargon. Our mandatory high school economics class doesn't even begin to explain what the actual situation is, much less to reveal the fatal flaws of capitalism, the necessity for perpetual growth, and the necessity to sell something to someone in order to profit. People watching the financial meltdown as portrayed in the media, the so-called subprime problem, might be wondering how it can be that a few low-income people defaulting on their home mortgages could bring down the entire financial system. Indeed, there is far more to that story. As mentioned on the program before, the dawn of the 1970s, the most prosperous time for the American middle class, that is, the time of highest wages, was also the point, according to the research of Professor Robert Brenner, that American manufacturing ceased to see profit growth. The first effort to boost profit growth was through automation and what was called downsizing of the workforce. But this proved to be inadequate to keep the profits growing. Technology made possible the next trend, outsourcing, namely the removal of the manufacturing entirely to low-wage countries. The problem with this is easy to see. The people you hope to sell to have less and less wherewithal to buy as their real wages have now decreased as a result of their good-paying jobs having been eliminated. Enter the next answer, the credit boom and the explosion of the so-called financial industry to enable people who have less and less money to buy more and more. Eventually, even those people can't keep buying. And you've got to find a way to keep selling things to an expanding customer base. Enter the mathematical whiz kids who came up with formulas that were to supposedly eliminate or reduce the risk of loaning to people on shaky financial grounds through the creation of financial instruments called derivatives. These derivatives were bundled and sold by lenders to others as a so-called investment, a process that came to be used in every area of debt, from consumer loans to corporate borrowing, creating an illusion of prosperity built on a mountain of debt, known in the financial industry as leverage. Paul Van Eeden is an independent financial consultant. Here's his explanation, given to interviewer Victor Adair of the Canadian financial website, HowStreet.com.
The talk is about subprime, but it's not really a subprime problem. Mm-hmm. The real problem, as Victor, you've said many times before, was that there was a credit bubble that fueled asset bubbles. Mm-hmm. But saying that it's a credit bubble actually still doesn't do total justice, because it was a mispricing of risk that I think is at the heart of this. And the easiest way to try and explain this, imagine that your neighbor takes out a mortgage, and the bank that originates the mortgage takes that mortgage and sells it to a mortgage broker. And the mortgage broker goes and looks at your neighbor and recognizes that, you know, in the mortgage application, he neglected to show any income. He doesn't have any net worth. And, you know, he has a temporary job, which, by the way, is what happened in the United States. Mm-hmm. These are called
liar loans, for instance.
Yeah, well, not liar loans, but these are loans that were created without full documentation. There is a specific category for these types of loans that were created without full documentation. And I'm not making this up. In the United States, leading up to this credit meltdown, it was possible to get a mortgage without any proof of income, any proof of assets, or any job security. Mm-hmm. All that happened is that it was a slightly different interest rate, okay? But still a low interest rate. Anyway, keep on with the story. The bank sells the mortgage to the mortgage broker. The mortgage broker goes to a bond insurance company and enters into a credit default swap, which basically means that the bond insurance company assumes the default risk on the mortgage in return for a quarterly payment. And because the mortgage broker now has insurance on this triple C or junk debt, all of a sudden becomes triple A because it's insured. Mm-hmm. So it packages up all this debt together, and then it sells it over to a pension fund. Okay? Now, basically what happened is that the pension fund pays almost the same for that as it does for other AAA debt, but underlying it is junk. Mm-hmm. And it was therefore a mispricing of risk, because they relied on the credit default swaps to take out the risk, the default risk. But what went wrong is that the bond insurance companies, if they had an A credit rating or better, were not required to put up any collateral for the credit default swaps that they entered into. And so you had companies like ACA Financial, as an example, which had $69 billion of default liability that it assumed on about a $460, $470 billion equity slice. And there was no way that they could make good on the defaults in an environment of rising default rates, which we have. So when the default rates started to rise, the credit rating agencies recognized that these bond insurance companies were not going to be able to make good on the credit default swaps, and therefore they downgraded the insurance companies. But the minute that they did that, then the buyers or the owners of this debt, which was now marked at AAA, recognized that, well, hold on a second, if the insurance is no good, then it isn't AAA, it's CCC again. Mm-hmm. And so there was a mispricing of debt because there was a mispricing of risk. And that's at the heart of the problem, because now the whole system is freezing up. You don't have sufficient creation of debt anymore, because the conduits through which all this debt flowed are freezing up. They're all going bankrupt. Everybody is trying to lay off liability on each other, and nobody knows how to solve the mess. So you're correct in saying that it was a credit bubble, but it was more than that. It was a credit bubble that went hand in hand with a complete miscalculation of credit risk. And all of this has to unwind now. And I suspect as this continues to unwind, that you will find the problems are not just in subprime. They're in prime. They're in Alt-A mortgages. They're in corporate debt products. They're in consumer debt like credit card products. They're in consumer debt like automobile products. Because all these products went through the same process of being upgraded through credit default swaps with insurance companies into a higher credit rating than what the underlying truly was. But because the credit insurers that assume the liability don't have the financial ability to make good on those credit default swaps.
For the less financially sophisticated explanation, the mispricing of risk, Van Eden described, is more aptly called fraud, and a raft of legal action is already underway by victims, many of whom were the pension funds of state and local governments. On Friday, Reuters News Service carried a story which is bound to become more common. New York City Comptroller William Thompson announced that he was expanding a class action lawsuit filed against Countrywide Financial Corporation, naming additional company officers and directors, 26 underwriters, and 2 accounting firms. Thompson said in a statement that executives of Countrywide Financial, one of the biggest U.S. mortgage lenders, recently bankrupt, cashed out to the tune of almost $700 million, while borrowers lost homes and the value of investors' shares fell sharply. We will pursue every avenue to ensure that those who defrauded investors are held accountable for their actions, said Thompson, who helps run the city's pensions. That from Reuters. We'll pursue this as an issue of fraud a little further with an article written by Dr. Jim Willey, a statistician who provides economic analysis and investment advice through his publication, The Hat Trick Letter, and on his website, goldenjackass.com. His January 24th article is titled, Gold and Math on a Napkin. Jim Willey wrote, "Bankers, Wall Street hucksters, financial network commentators, and floating analysts seem to have flunked basic arithmetic in grand fashion. Maybe they only expose the next link in a long chain of deception, their apparent expertise. One hears estimates of $200 billion on total mortgage bond losses from the Secretary of Inflation, Ben Bernanke. One witnesses the series of bond write-downs by Wall Street banks. One can read of Wall Street economists like Jan Hatzius of Goldman Sachs, who cites $400 billion in potential bond losses, a favorite figure cited by other bankers. One is subjected to press anchors and their simplistic echoes of bond losses. One is endlessly lectured by highbrow analysts of the extent of bond damage. The trouble is, they all cannot do simple arithmetic and observe the billboards on mortgage bond indexes fully available. Put aside for a minute the fact that the mortgage debacle in the United States is described as a subprime loan problem. The entire gaggle of banker goons and press parrots have their reasons for insisting on focusing entirely on subprimes. It makes the problem more marginal, more understandable, more excusable. Dumb lenders gave home loans to bad borrowers. Okay. Follow this path of incredibly easy math. The total of U.S. dollar-based mortgage bonds is $10.4 trillion. A conservative estimate of the prime mortgages within this giant mass is $7 trillion. We all know it is more, so bear with my lowball for argument's sake. The prime mortgage bond index measures an aggregate of prime-rated bonds scattered across the beleaguered 50 states, varying over loan size from large to medium to small. The AAA mortgage bond index has lost a whopping 30%, a fact that continuously eludes the big bankers and their legion of obsequious monitoring mavens. Simple math within the grasp of a 9-year-old kid results in prime mortgage losses amounting to at least $2.1 trillion. The kid might have trouble with all the zeros, though, and even be confused by what a trillion is. A trillion is a million millions. The size of the subprime mortgages in the United States is estimated at $1.4 trillion. The BBB mortgage bond index has lost 80% of its value. It, too, measures an aggregate of such mortgage bonds across the U.S. of various size loans. So subprime mortgage bonds have lost over $1.1 trillion. If subprime bonds have lost a trillion, why cannot supposed experts estimate that the total asset-backed bond losses to be at least a cool trillion? Add the two numbers from subprime and prime together to reach a $3.2 trillion bond loss. This total does not include the middle-tier Alt-A mortgages, no small sum either. That is probably close to another $1 trillion in bond losses. Alt-A mortgages do not receive much attention. They are essentially more subprime slime with a more obscure name. Their decline rate for associated bonds is almost as horrible as the subprimes. Even if they are omitted in the argument, the point remains just as dire. This summer, the avalanche of innovative prime adjustable mortgages will be the wreckage to report. The bonds have fallen in value, but the write-offs have yet to make the news. All in time. Let's summarize in plain bold letters so as to avoid any confusion. These comments require plain language. Clear numbers are needed in clear statements. Prime mortgage bond losses at least $2 trillion. Subprime mortgage bond losses over $1 trillion. Total mortgage bond losses are over $3 trillion. The official estimates are wrong by a factor of 10. Gold will skyrocket when these numbers are finally reported. So why are all the so-called experts spouting about $200 billion in total bond losses? Why are Wall Street economists talking about $400 billion in extensive losses? A simple conclusion is that they prefer to lie and deceive as they defend their industry. Most savvy observers are hard-pressed to identify the last time Wall Street and their gaggle of advertisement vehicles actually told the truth. When people ask me why such a huge volume of lies is routinely told, my answer is always the same. Check the advertisers of CNBC, Wall Street Journal, Barron's, even Investors Business Daily. They are almost all the same. Big banks, brokerage houses, mutual funds, mortgage lenders, and related firms, most of them headquartered in New York City. By the way, not a single felony conviction has stuck against a New York City defendant in court. All the convictions are of non-club members roaming other regions. The consequence of being beholden to such a chorus of advertisers is lost objectivity, blatant bias, active deception, and comprehensive obstruction to present the facts in a truthful light. Their message has become simple. Don't panic, wait it out, because we are desperately trying to sell from our cratering portfolios. The U.S. government stimulus package of $150 billion is being floated, replete with minor tax cuts and a puny amount of money doled out to each household. This is peanuts. Ben Bernanke is a bit late in living up to his name of Helicopter Ben, actually, a name in no way deserved, not yet. Questions are asked if the U.S. government fiscal plan is enough. Of course not. The stimulus is 10 times smaller than required, because the estimated size of the problem is 10 times smaller than reality. Unless and until the authorities in charge of this implosion of financially engineered tinker toys get serious, when a rescue package and resolution platform are designed and put into action valued in the trillions, they are urinating on raging bonfires. The U.S. Fed has put a very small amount of money into the banking system since August, under $20 billion net. And by U.S. Fed, he's referring to the Federal Reserve Bank. Continuing. Without any doubt, the Wall Street conmen and the clueless rookies running the U.S. Federal Reserve choose not to properly assess the problem. They are totally unwilling to tell the public that the risk price modeling system is being unraveled totally. that the mortgage debacle has wrecked the banking system totally, that the U.S. economy is going to be dragged down in tragedy. The U.S. Fed and even the U.S. Department of Treasury are delighted to see a recession, since it makes demand grow for U.S. treasuries, meaning treasury bonds. Therein lies a blatant bias. These clowns talk a lot about transparency when such spotlights have exposed the banking system as insolvent. These charlatans talk a lot about the virtues of home ownership when they have become agents to destroy life savings. A grotesque transfer of wealth has taken place using mortgage bonds as the theft vehicle. From the homeowners to the mortgage originators and mortgage bond sales force, from fees, big investment institutions are bag holders, like pension funds, insurance firms, hedge funds. As U.S. Treasury bill yields decline, borrowing costs for the increasingly bankrupt U.S. book of business decline. Borrowing costs might become a huge portion of the ongoing federal budget and its deficit. Banking leaders much prefer a recession to a big bout of price inflation. They have a destructive policy at work to prevent what they call secondary inflation effects from taking root. In other words, they can tolerate systemic price inflation in energy costs, material costs, service costs, insurance costs, but heaven forbid any increase in wages. They steer the system towards a middle-class squeeze. Wages have fallen, by U.S. government nitwit analysis, by 4% to 5% since 2003 on an inflation-adjusted basis. So if realistic inflation adjustment is used, employing the 7% to 10% consumer price index rise seen in the last few years, the middle class has suffered a 20% to 25% wage crush in real terms. Those analysts who have been forecasting severe problems did not receive proper credit. Instead, they are criticized, disrespected, and called lucky. They are even called part of the problem, as they contribute to the erosion of confidence. My position is steadfast, consistent, and stern. The U.S. financial system embodies institutional dishonesty, fully intertwined throughout the entire system. With each passing month, another huge story of fraud is revealed. We need a new cable television network just to track U.S. financial fraud. And that an excerpt from a January 24th article by Dr. Jim Woolley of GoldenJackass.com titled Gold and Math on a Napkin. And this brings us to our featured speaker, Tom Hartman, broadcaster and an author of many books, including the recent title, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove.
Here's
or
Tom
WMRW,
Hartman speaking a couple of
Warren.
Months ago to a community group in Ventura County, California.
What I'd like to start out with tonight, if I may, is bursting a few myths, because we've got a lot of myths in our society, and in fact, some of these myths are the things that have led to the some would say dire circumstances that we're facing right now, and there are some relatively subtle myths. I mean, Al Gore's out there doing a great job with the big stuff, like, you know, global warming and things. These are the things that actually are the structural underpinnings that make it possible for the mess like global warming to have come about without anybody, you know, seeing it coming down the road and saying, hey, wait a minute, as a democratic society, we need to be looking at this. We need to be thinking in terms of what's the future. You know, the old Iroquois Confederacy, every decision made in the context of the seventh generation. What happened to that? Where did that go? Why are we not thinking like that? And what the first myth, and so I'm going to kind of bounce back and forth between these two books, the content of these two books. And the first couple of myth things are out of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. And it's this idea that a middle class is a normal thing. We have a generation of Americans who, by and large, have grown up experiencing the middle class all around them. Pretty much anybody who was born after 1940, I would say, up until today, has had the experience of believing at some kind of visceral level that a middle class is a normal thing. After all, isn't that what, you know, is mostly around us, or is certainly something that we can aspire to? And in fact, you know, historically, the American dream was the middle class dream. It was about, you know, being able to buy a home and have a car and raise the kids and have a pension and have health insurance and have a decent life. Ronald Reagan recalibrated the American dream very aggressively, he and his handlers in the 1980s, to be, no, the American dream is about becoming incredibly filthy rich, and that's what everybody should aspire to, and now we kind of have this lottery psychology that's going on. But that really historically wasn't what America was about. It wasn't the American dream. The problem is that middle classes, the phenomena of a middle class, as we refer to it in the United States, is not a normal thing. In fact, it's not even a normal thing for the United States of America. If you look back at the census of 1900, and in fact look at the various states of life of average Americans throughout the 1800s, from around 1830, more or less, is when the first middle class in America really began to collapse. And some would argue that that collapse really, you know, as it picked up steam in the 1840s and 1850s, in many ways led directly to the Civil War. And following that, there was a real collapse of the middle class during Reconstruction and the Gilded Age. So that by 1900, in the census of 1900, the average income of the average American was $9,700 a year in today's dollars. Most people were very poor. The only middle class that we had in the United States at that time, from basically about 1830 until basically around 1930 or 1940, arguably, the only middle class we had in the United States was small family farms, which was a large, actually, percentage of Americans, and the mercantile class, the people who owned, you know, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, people who owned small businesses, or if those businesses were being a lawyer or a doctor, the professional class, and that was not a lot of people. That was not, you know, a large number of people. So how did that first middle class come about that was there in the 1700s? How did the second middle class in America come about in the late 20th century, post-1940, that we're seeing the remnants of now that are being shredded? And how do middle classes come about in general? David Ricardo, back in 1816, as I recall, it might have been 1814, it was one or the other, he wrote two papers, one in one of those years and one in the other. One's called On Profits, and the other was called On Labor. And parenthetically, in On Profits, he pointed out an inconvenient truth, which is that the price of a product in the marketplace bears no resemblance, or little resemblance, to its actual cost of manufacture. Of course, it's going to be above the cost of manufacture, but the fact of the matter is that a price of the product in the marketplace is a function of what it can be sold for. So when Phil Knight figured out how to make tennis shoes cheaper, and also control the supply and increase the demand for them, he was able to raise their price even though his cost had gone down, and so his profits went up. So profits are a function of the marketplace. So anyhow, Ricardo wrote this piece called On Profits, which blows apart the free market idea, which we'll get to in a second. And then he wrote another piece called On Labor. And this was, it's one of the great classics of economics, David Ricardo's On Labor. And what he pointed out was that when the available supply of labor is roughly equal to the demand for labor, the price of labor will not become, that is, the wages that are paid, will not become what we might call a middle class. The price of labor instead will fall to what he referred to as a subsistence level, the absolute minimum necessary to survive. In other words, what is normal is the working poor. They're making enough money that they're not starving. They're making enough money that they're not freezing to death, but they don't have what we would call a middle-class life. And they live a life of great insecurity and economic fear. And he said, that's what's normal. That's what an absolutely unregulated economy will always produce, when the supply of labor equals the demand for labor. And if you look back in history, you see that, literally you can do this, and people have, with ancient Incan and Mayan civilizations. You can do this with the dynasties of China. I mean, you can find these same parallels. I'll use European society because most people are familiar with it. We teach it in our schools. For 1,000 years in Europe, Europe had basically no middle class. There were the serfs. I mean, the people, the vast majority of people, 95% easily of the people, everything that they possessed was actually not their property. They didn't even own their own clothes. They didn't own their own homes. Their homes were on the land of the king. Their clothes were the property of the king. In fact, it's really interesting. I lived in Germany for a year, 86, 87. And we lived in this little town in the middle of nowhere. It's called Stadtsteinach, a little town of about 12,000 people. And there was another town nearby, Gumpersdorf. And Gumpersdorf had like 400 people. And there was all these little towns around there, and there's this one central castle in the area. And I noticed after I'd lived there a couple of months that everybody kind of looked the same. I mean, it was like you were looking at a bunch of cousins. You know what I'm talking about? I mean, all around this maybe 100 square mile area. And if you went 100 miles to the south down toward, in the direction of Munich, we were in the Frankenwald up in the northern part of Bavaria. And if you went, 100 miles south, then, in the area where I lived, everybody kind of had wide noses at the end, and they tended to have a certain type of chin. And I mean, I'm serious, these facial features. And you go 100 miles south, and you see an entire town where everybody kind of looks slightly different. Everybody's hair is, instead of a little brown, it's a little red. And I commented to somebody about, isn't this weird? I mean, is this because the Germans just never move? And he says, well, that's part of it. He said, but mostly it's the rite of the first night. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, for 1,000 years in Europe, the local king, the law was that when a woman got married, the first night, she had to sleep with the king. And then she got to sleep with her husband after that. And that was literally the law in Europe. And so what happened was the king had a lot of kids, all over the community. And what this produced, arguably there was some sort of bizarre Darwinian use to this, at least from the king's point of view, because, now everybody in the community, they can kind of tell by looking at their kids, oh, yeah, that's one of the king's kids. And he's got the same nose, yep. And so it produced actually social cohesion. It produced this sense of this is our tribe and that's their tribe and we got the big noses and they got the big chins, or whatever. But it's really an illustration of how people did not even own their own bodies. They did not even own their own DNA, their own lineage. So, that was that normal that David Ricardo was talking about. There was the very wealthy and there was the very poor, and then there were a few mercantile middle-class folks in there, but very, very, very few. And even they essentially had no rights. And this was static. I mean, Europe was relatively stable like this for 1,000 years, the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages. And then all of a sudden, In the mid to late 1400s, I forget the year, I think it was 1435, the bubonic plague, as I recall, it was right around then anyway, in that neighborhood. And the plague, they referred to it as the Black Plague because these black blisters would appear and from dead skin, necrotic skin. And it swept Europe and it killed a third of the people alive. In some places it killed half of the people. And the consequence of that was that for the next generation, Now we're looking at the 1450s, the 1460s, the 1470s. For the next generation, the supply of here's the demand for labor. The supply of labor is all of a sudden down here. So what does that do? That causes the price of labor to go up. The price of labor goes up, and what happened? A middle class emerged. First middle class Europe had seen in 1,000 years, in the middle 1400s. People had time to make music. People had time to think about philosophy. People had time to write poetry. People had time to flip off their boss. People had, you know, it's like they there was, and we refer to this period of time as the Renaissance. You know, because it literally was. I mean, it was this great awakening because people had enough time and they were able to. And this was, you know, the beginning. I mean, it laid the foundation for the first British civil rights movement. It was the first real serious building on the Magna Carta, which had been, you know, signed 200 or 400 years earlier. I mean, it was the first middle class in Europe. And then that middle class kind of faded away in the 1500s, because after three or four or five generations, the population just kept multiplying to the point where it met the demand for labor, and the price of labor collapsed. And so by the mid-1500s, people were willing to, in the late 1500s, early 1600s, were willing to go to people like Christopher Columbus, and, well, actually, he was earlier than that, but, you know, his followers, and say, yes, I'll sign on for that sea voyage to cross the sea that's, you know, only 20% of the people who undertake it die en route. Because it's better than what I've got here, you know, and they started populating North and South America, and what came out of that, and Africa and Asia and India, and the consequence of that, what came out of that, was that they discovered gold in large quantities in South and Central America, and they began importing slaves, and they began bringing in resources from other places, and so there was this confluence of resources. Of cheap labor that was exogenous to, you know, that was outside of the local population, cheap labor, gold, enormous wealth. I mean, the Spanish in the Aztec and Mayan lands, the Spanish king actually apportioned out areas for mining as mining claims, and they were digging up these old burial, these thousand, I mean, it was 1,000 years of collecting gold on the part of the Aztecs, and they're finding these priceless artifacts, and they were melting them down into 20-pound bars so that the king could collect a tax before they got shipped to Spain. And we're talking thousands of tons of gold that ended up in Europe. So what happened then wasn't that the price, that the amount of labor went down, but that because Europe suddenly became so much wealthier as a consequence of, frankly, all this robbery and pillaging, the demand for labor increased. And so, again, you had that imbalance. So now the demand for labor is above the availability of labor. So what happens? The price of labor goes up, and a second middle class emerged in the 1600s. And that middle class we refer to as the Enlightenment. And in the early years of the Enlightenment, you had Hobbes, and then you had Locke and Rousseau, and I'm going to talk about all that, them in just a minute. And then, you know, over time, that wealth got distributed or got grabbed, glommed onto by the people who were in the business of aggregating wealth and not letting it get into the hands of the rest of the people. And, you know, arguably by the early 1800s, that middle class was going away too. And at the same time, throughout the late 1600s and the early 1700s and throughout the 1700s, a middle class was emerging among the Europeans who had come to North America, again, as a consequence of what they were able to steal, essentially. You know, they would kill off the Indians, take their land, take their, you know, eat their fish, take their cattle or their buffaloes, and, you know, and so on. And boom, you've got a demand for labor that exceeds the supply of labor. So the price of labor goes up, so poof, you've got a middle class. And yes, it was driven by a whole bunch of very dysfunctional things. It was driven by slavery. It was driven by theft of land. It was, you know, et cetera. But it was there. I mean, just looking at the raw economics of it. And what's interesting is that during the middle class of the Renaissance, during the middle class of the Enlightenment, and Jefferson and Madison and Washington, these guys fell right smack dab in the middle of the tail end of the Enlightenment, right? And during both of those middle classes, what you saw was a lot of popular revolt. You saw people saying, you know, no to the established order, saying no to religions. You had religious, literally reformations. You had the church institutions that had ruled Europe for 1,000 years losing power, losing land, losing, you know, right across the board. You had So this incredible transformation. And perhaps most importantly, you had a middle class that said no to King George III, the third George to rule England. We're now in the third George to be president of America. I find that a small coincidence. Think about it. George Washington, George Bush, George Bush. Yeah, okay, three Georges. What does that mean? So anyway, that middle class stood up to George III and said, "Hell no, you know, we won't go. We're not going to take this anymore. We're not going to be ruled by the East India Company. We're not going to be ruled by the British elite. We're capable of governing ourselves." Well, that was kind of the good news. I mean, it led to the creation of the United States, and it led to the first experiment based on the thinking that had been laid out in the 1600s about the possibility of a liberal democracy. The bad news is that eventually the free land ran out. I mean, there was a little mini boom with the California Gold Rush, but you know, the wealth ran out, the resources ran out, the buffalo got killed, the fish got fished, the forest got cut, the land got fenced, and by 1830, that middle class was starting to fade. And so we had a 100-year period in the United States where, for all practical purposes, there wasn't a strong middle class. There were people who were trying to create a middle class. You had, particularly after the Civil War, you had the emergence of the Wobblies, you had the emergence of the Grange Movement, was the Farmers Union. Yeah, I mean, you had all these union attempts. You had people saying, actually what they were trying to do was decrease the availability of labor to increase the price of labor. So they did it with things like making it illegal for children to be in the workplace. What does that do? It reduces the availability of labor. And you know, reducing the number of hours that people can work. Let's have a 50-hour work week. You know, Teddy Roosevelt's, yeah. And so there were all these efforts from the 1870s to the 1930s to jumpstart a middle class, but none of them really quite worked. And finally, the Great Depression was this huge wake-up, the Republican Great Depression of, you know, 1929 to 1940. And Franklin Roosevelt was elected in 1932 and inaugurated as president. And he said, okay, we're going to try to create a middle class. Now, the problem is, and this is what John Maynard Keynes was saying to him, you know, his principal economic advisor, was saying, or one of the thinkers that from whom much of this stuff was derived, was saying, here's the problem. A middle class is not a normal thing. If you have a completely unregulated economy, what you're going to end up with is what we've had for the last 100 years. Which is a whole lot of poor working people and a small number of very wealthy, powerful people and a couple people who have enough skills or the ability to, you know, like the Masons, you know, enough to create a guild or a union that they can demand a higher price. But you can have a small middle class and a small ruling class and a very large and broad working class. This, by the way, is the story, you know, as we go into the Christmas season now. This is the story of A Christmas Carol. You know, Dickens wrote about this. I mean, this is where Victorian England was at. The middle class was gone. This was not the height of empire. This was the beginning of the end of empire. This was, you know, the wealth was gone, and the population was growing like crazy. And so you know, we think of Scrooge as, you know, this wealthy guy. Well, he wasn't. Scrooge was the middle class. He was a small businessman with one employee. Bob Cratchit represented the average person. That was the vast mass of people in England. You know, please, sir, may I have a lump of coal? My fingers are cold. No, you may not. It'll cost me a pence. You know, and it's Scrooge, the middle class, just holding on for all he can because he's just got this little one, you know, two-man business. And then, of course, there was the kings and the lords, you know, and the barons. And there were the real wealth. But, I mean, Dickens doesn't even address the real wealth. He's dealing with the battle between the middle class and the working poor. And he knew it well because his own father had been thrown into debtor's prison. And he very accurately portrayed what it was like in Victoria, England. You know, please, sir, may I have health care for Tiny Tim? No! You know, it sort of sounds like the Republican debates these days. You know, it's health care! Are you kidding? Yeah. So Franklin Roosevelt said, we're going to create a middle class. You know, we want to create a middle class. We think that that's something that would be a good thing for democracy. It would be a good thing for America. The problem is it's never been done before. I mean, we've seen middle classes before, but we're not going to introduce a bubonic plague and kill off a third of Americans. I mean, that would do it, but we're not going to do that. And we've run out of Indians to steal from. I mean, there were still a few, but... And we're not going to go back to slavery, and we're not, you know, no more Aztecs to find. So what are we going to do? Well, how about if we tried regulating the economic system? What if we came up with the radical idea that, unlike the old right of the first night times, that we the people are not here to serve those who control the economy, but rather those who have the reins of the economy are here to serve we the people, that we authorize them to engage in business. And by authorizing them, I mean, I've started a number of corporations in my life, and every single time you have to go to the Secretary of State's office and say and fill out a form and ask for permission to have a corporation. And in exchange for doing business, which is presumably going to produce some kind of social good, it's going to produce employment, it's going to produce goods, there is value associated with that. In exchange for that, I get certain immunities. You know, you get the ability to, the corporation can declare bankruptcy and it doesn't affect you, for example. You have limited liability. The corporation in many cases can do things that if individuals did, they'd go to jail and the corporation just gets wiped out or hurt. Or if it's, you know, a big multinational corporation, just pays a small fine and makes a political contribution. But in any case, So Franklin Roosevelt said, let's flip this thing upside down and just say, you know, that the economy is here to serve the people. And he did a whole series of things. He said, you know, we're just going to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks, as much stuff as we can. And they made the employer of last resort with the WPA and the CCC and unemployment insurance and maximum hour laws and, you know, minimum wage laws. You know, one of the big arguments in the United States before it was the United States in the 1760s, there were still, in the United States, before the Revolutionary War, there were still maximum wage laws. These are a remnant of England. For 500 years in England, there had been maximum wage laws. It was against the law for Scrooge to pay Bob Cratchit more than a certain amount because the wealthy, the real centers of power, did not want the rabble to be empowered. And, you know, when the rabble finally got some power in France, it was pretty ugly, and that's what they knew was going to come. You know, that's what... So Roosevelt said, hey, maximum wage laws for 1,000 years? We're going to flip that one upside down. We're going to minimum wage laws. I mean, these are radical concepts at the time in the 1930s. The Wagner Act in 1935 would give people the right to unionize and give labor some say in its own cost. In other words, you know, limit the supply of labor so that the price of labor will end up being more expensive. And what came out of that series of experiments was two things. One, it was the first great American middle class, the first middle class arguably in the world, that wasn't the result of either a disaster or plunder. It was the result of a gradual lowering, down distribution of wealth to most people. I mean, there was about a 5-7% reduction in the overall wealth of the top 1% of Americans during that 40-year period from 1930 to 1970, or from 1940 to 1980, you know, in that neighborhood, over what it had been before 1930. And by the way, since 1980, it's gone back to that 5%. In other words, it's swung back up. And as it has, what we've seen is that at a certain level, a zero-sum game. As the rich get richer, the poor actually do get poorer. And the middle class gets pushed into the category of the poor. So, you know, I guess it's kind of a good news, bad news story. The bad news is that the middle class isn't a normal thing. The good news is that we know how to create it. Oh, I said two things came out of it. The second thing that came out of it was that after World War II, Franklin Roosevelt, well, Roosevelt was dead by then, but, you know, Harry Truman carrying on the tradition, when the Marshall Plan was put into place and they were rebuilding, the Marshall Plan not in Japan, but as they were rebuilding Japan and as they were rebuilding Europe and all these kind of things. Harry Truman in 1947, the Republicans took control of both the House and the Senate in 1946 and promptly passed the Taft-Hartley Act to chop labor off at the knees, and Truman vetoed it and they overrode his veto. And then he proposed a single-payer health care system for the entire United States. Everybody has health care as a right, not a privilege. And the Republicans shot that down in the House and Senate. And Harry Truman, oddly enough, was not the first guy to propose that, by the way. The first person to propose that was Thomas Paine in the United States in his book, The Rights of Man, and in his public speaking. In any case, what happened was that Japan and Germany, as they were putting themselves together, Truman went over and said, hey, psst, I can't get this thing through the House and Senate here in the United States, this this strong rights of unionization. I mean, they've already taken a whack at it with the Taft-Hartley Act, and health care is a right, not a privilege, but you guys might want to think about writing it into your Constitution. And they did. And what happened was that they became these economic powerhouses, and some of the other Asian countries and many of the other European countries looked at that and said, hey, we can do that too. And so now, you know, Roosevelt's middle class is spread across Europe, and now it's the European dream, not the American dream, you know, of being the middle class. In fact, there's a book by that title out. So, you know, the these two things came out of it, and like I said, the bad news is middle class is not a normal thing. The good news is that we know how to do it now. We went through that period of experimentation. It's not rocket science. It can be done. The only problem is it requires pushing back against those who, in my opinion, is a consequence of mental illness, frankly, of obsessive compulsive disorder associated with money. You know, when I was a kid, I used to read Donald Duck comic books, you know, and there was Uncle Scrooge, not the Scrooge from the Dickens novel, and he would, you know, immerse himself in his money bin, you know, but he would never give anybody a tip. I mean, he was mentally ill. He had obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, and instead of connecting it with washing his hands or something like that, he had connected it with money. And so anyway, it requires society to slightly reorganize itself. And we've been steadily unraveling that ever since 1980, ever since the election of Reagan, and arguably for about 5 to 10 years before that as the meme of deregulation started coming into our discourse as a consequence of these think tanks that were created. So that's the first myth that I wanted to blow up. The next one that I'd like to explode is the myth that democracy is not normal. Okay, the first was that the middle class is normal. Sorry, not the case. The middle class requires a democratic institution. It requires the consensus of the majority of the people, the activity of the majority of the people, and the majority of the people have to say, okay, this is how we're going to organize it. So a middle class is not normal, whereas we've always believed that it was. The other myth is that democracy, which we've always believed was not normal, and that's been the consensus, frankly, since the Greeks. It's something that noble people do, right? We're going to restrain our baser impulses, but because we're smart, we're humans, we're different than the animals, where they've got alpha deer and alpha wolves and alpha, you know, isn't nature all organized hierarchically? There's the queen bee and the king ant or whatever, the queen ant, or, you know, Darwin wrote about this. I mean, we've always looked at nature as a society, as in science and in culture, and said, you know, it's organized hierarchically. That must be the way that naturally is how things are. And so let's organize human society that way, with a king and a queen and, you know, the lords in the middle and all the worker bees. And isn't that how it's supposed to be? And the king and the queen get to make all the decisions. Or the king or the queen or whatever. And so there was a couple of scientists, Tim Conrad and A.J. Roper, at the University of Sussex, I think, either Sussex or Essex, I mix those two cities up, but one or the other, in the UK, who said, let's test this hypothesis. Is it possible that we've been wrong? You know, that we've always thought that democracy is not natural, that it's something, that it's a human invention, it's something that we created with our minds, something that requires us to, you know, to think lofty thoughts, and that, in fact, it's something maybe that animals do. So they had a herd of red deer near the university, and they set up cameras in the trees to watch the deer, figure out what's going on with these deer. And the deer had to engage in a decision-making process. Now, in this herd of red deer, there was every spring the competition of the males, where they butt heads and bang each other around, and a couple would end up as the alpha deers, you know, I Claudius, and So, you know, it was clearly a hierarchical society, wasn't it? And that's what they thought.